If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Hollywood has set the cultural agenda for America and the wider world for more than 100 years, and it's produced some of the greatest and most glamorous stars of the 20th century. So what's the secret to its success? Spencer Mizzen sat down with Mark Glancy, Professor of Film History at Queen Mary University of London, to answer your questions on Hollywood history for our latest Everything You Wanted to Know episode.
Now, Mark, everyone's heard of Hollywood unless they've been living on Mars for the last few decades, but they might not know a great deal about its origins. So I thought I'd start with the following two questions, both submitted on social media. They are, why did the movie industry originally move to Hollywood, i.e. why was the area so attractive to filmmakers? That's from Robert Keynes on Facebook. And also, I've got a question, what did Hollywood look like before the film industry moved there? And that's from Jess Dinning on Instagram.
Well, they're both really, they're great questions because we have to remember Hollywood was so far flung from the rest of the United States at the turn of the century. Los Angeles was a small city then, and it was several days traveling time from the East Coast. So it was quite a big move to go somewhere like Los Angeles. And Hollywood was just a tiny suburb of Los Angeles, about 8 miles further west from Los Angeles. It was a village with several homes. Around 1907, I think, it got a hotel. People liked to take the train west and go to see the area because the area was beautiful. It had mountains. It was near the sea. It was warm. This beautiful valley floor. When you see old pictures of it, it does look like a kind of paradise. And it brings to mind the Joni Mitchell song, you know, they paved paradise and put up a parking lot because it's so paved over now. But that's why the filmmakers went out there. They found a place where they could film, where there was plenty of space. And They could film in the mountains. There was a desert across the mountains. There was the ocean, of course. And so it made a great place to film outdoors on location, as many films were made then. There was another reason, slightly shadier reason, that a lot of movie making equipment, a lot of the production equipment, was under patent at the time, and the patents meant that you had to pay to use the machinery, and going out to the West Coast meant that you could dodge some of those payments. So some of the more strapped filmmakers were eager to be far away from the East Coast, where a lot of the film studios were then, and come out to Hollywood.
So who were the main drivers behind this move?
Well, there were films made in Hollywood before 1913. A few short films. D.W. Griffith went out to Hollywood sometime in the first decade of the century and made short films. But the really big change came when Cecil B. DeMille in 1913 made a Western called The Squaw Man. And he'd been trying to make that on other Western locations and not having any luck with the weather and the scenery and all the rest of it. So he heard about Hollywood and he went out there and made this very popular Western. And that really started, he continued to make films in Hollywood, but it gave other filmmakers the idea too. And it very rapidly developed into the filmmaking capital of the United States and indeed the world.
And can you paint a picture of what the film industry, especially the American film industry, was like at this time?
Disorganized. It was nowhere near as centralized as it became in Hollywood. So that's one of the big changes that happens when the film studios move out west and become establish facilities in and around Hollywood. You very rapidly get the industry matures and becomes much more centralized around several companies, not just a few companies, but several companies. But before that, it was a much more disparate and spread out industry.
So you had a lot of the main players move into this area at this similar time, is that right?
That's right. A lot of the main players moved to the area and they're very successful there. And that success builds on itself. More filmmakers come. The companies get bigger. They buy other companies. They merge. And that's why within 10 years of Cecil B. DeMille coming out to Hollywood, you pretty much have the major studios, all those names that we know so well, in place and making films and making a lot of money.
Now, the next question, which also was submitted on social media from Sarah Damery, is, did the transition from silent film to talkies really destroy many actors' careers? So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about when the switch from silent to talkies occurred and who were the main stars of the silent film era?
The switch from silent films to talkies really got going with The Jazz Singer, a Warner Brothers film released in 1927, starring Al Jolson, in which Jolson sings. There's not a lot of talking in the film. It's known as the first talkie. There's not actually a lot of talking in it. Al Jolson was a singer and he sang. And it was a huge success. And that began a process of the process of transitioning to talking films. But it took a while, because you have to remember that every cinema had to be wired for sound, had to be wired for this new technology. Many cinemas, smaller cinemas, might have only had a piano that they played while the silent films were on. So every cinema that's going to show Hollywood films around the world has to be wired for sound. And so it was a process that took three years.
And is it true? Did it destroy some actors' careers?
Well, I mean, there's truth and there's myth in this. I think the myth is perpetuated by Singing in the Rain, a wonderful film, a very funny film, and this idea that Lena Lamont, with her screeching voice, was typical of silent stars who couldn't survive the transition to talkies. And there's a little bit of truth in that. There were some silent stars whose voices did not suit their image. And when you think about it, back in the silent days, when you never heard a star, you can imagine them having any accent that you wanted them to have, so that they could be anything. And it could be a bit of a problem when you heard them for the first time and thought, that's not what I imagined. So it did ruin a few careers, but it wasn't the kind of overwhelming change that it's sometimes portrayed to be, and certainly that Singing in the Rain portrays it to be.
And who are the main stars of this era then? Are there many names that people would recognise now?
Douglas Fairbanks was one of the great stars of this period. He and another was his wife, Mary Pickford. They were probably Hollywood's first power couple. They were really prominent, really popular stars who made films mostly separately. Charlie Chaplin, I'm sure most people have heard of, still wonderful comedian, and he was one of the biggest. I suppose people have heard of Rudolph Valentino, the ultimate Latin lover, and also a very good actor too.
Now then, our next question comes from Brendan Mitchell, and this was submitted on Facebook, and he wants to know, what was unique about the golden era of film? What made it golden? And I wonder, just to elaborate on that a little, could you just talk a little bit about the golden era of film? When are we talking about, and why did cinema become so much more popular during this period?
I think the golden era lasts from the 1920s, when the Hollywood studio system is first in place, and into the 1950s when it begins to disintegrate. It was a system that was very much based around stardom, selling films through stars who were very carefully manufactured, and their image was maintained very carefully. It was very much to do with glamour and romance. And I think censorship plays a big role in it as well, because Hollywood was heavily censored at that time. And that meant that films weren't as sort of gritty, perhaps disturbing, violent as they became later. And so there's a kind of glamorous aura around them during this period of the studio system, which is also a period of heavy censorship.
And how did the technology play into this? I guess evolving technology really, really, really helped supercharge the growth of Hollywood at this time. The fact that, you know, these productions could be shown all over vast swathes of the world.
The technology was, of course, important. And by having the industry in Hollywood, in and around Hollywood, you develop a film culture and a group of technological experts who help to advance filmmaking through this time. And I think in addition to the technology, it's important to remember the technicians, because one thing that happens with Hollywood is, one really important thing that happens with Hollywood is, you get technicians coming from all over the world. It very rapidly becomes the international film capital. And so you have Russian filmmakers, German filmmakers, French filmmakers, British filmmakers, of course, all from all the film capitals in Europe. People want to go to Hollywood and work there, and they bring with them the technical knowledge and expertise from their own countries.
And who are the biggest stars of this period from, say, the late 1920s until just after the Second World War?
The biggest stars of that really crucial period, probably Clark Gable, I would say, is the biggest male star, and one who was just extraordinarily popular. Greta Garbo, the Swedish star who came to Hollywood and became very, very popular. Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Gary Cooper, and of course the wonderful Cary Grant as well. All very popular and sustained careers over decades as well.
Now, a question is asked quite a lot on internet search queries is kind of related to this. It is, to what extent did Hollywood project American culture into the wider world? I mean, would you say it was like a kind of tool of soft power for America?
I think Hollywood absolutely was a tool of soft power. When you think about it, audiences around the world are so much more familiar with the United States than they would be without Hollywood. They know how Americans live, the kind of houses they live in, the sort of foods they eat, the cars they drive, all the products they use, and that's, of course, great marketing for American products. Hollywood films tend to be patriotic, and so there's a sense in which the rest of the world knows about America's achievements and what makes Americans proud. So there is this side to it that seems very pro-American and very much a tool of soft power, encouraged by the U.S. Department of Commerce, by the way, a government agency that made sure that from the beginning made sure that Hollywood films could be shown around the world because they knew that trade would follow the film. As it was said, trade follows the film. But I think there's a flip side to it, that most Americans wouldn't say Hollywood represents them well. Most Americans would resent that idea and say that Hollywood was in some ways un-American. Back in the golden era, I think people would say Hollywood was un-American because it was decadent or immoral. They would look to the scandals in Hollywood and say, that's not America, and that's not projecting American values. Whereas now, of course, it's elitism and the idea that everyone in Hollywood's left wing that makes it seem un-American to some.
And when you say Hollywood films were shown across the world, I mean, was it literally all corners of the earth? Was it truly global?
It was truly global, apart from the Soviet Union. The Soviets banned Hollywood films. That meant that whenever Hollywood needed a villain, they made them Russian because they didn't have to worry about offending the Russians. The Russians weren't paying customers, but they were wary of offending other countries because most other countries, and the industrialized countries, did show films and did import American films. So, you know, things happened along the way. When the Nazis came to power, they gradually banned American films. They just sort of weaned their cinemas off American films over a period of years. But certainly by the time, by 1941, there were no American films, no new American films showing in Germany.
And here's another internet search query, and that is, what was Hollywood's role in the two world wars? How was its output shaped by the conflicts?
With the First World War, you have to remember that America wasn't in it for as long as America was in the Second World War. So I don't think there was quite the same degree of mobilization of the film industry. The film industry wasn't as organized, and there wasn't the kind of forward planning that would happen with the Second World War. So when I think of the First World War and Hollywood, I tend to think of the way Hollywood portrayed the war in retrospect. In the 1920s in particular, you think about All Quiet on the Western Front, the big parade, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, these rather grand, somewhat anti-war films that were made after the war. The Second World War was a different story because it was seen coming for a long period of time. So even before the war, even before the United States was in the war, the United States entered in 1941, for a few years before that, Hollywood was already making anti-Nazi films and trying to raise the alarm in America about Nazi Germany. When the United States entered the war in 1941, the government was very keen to use Hollywood as a propaganda tool and established an agency in Hollywood to advise on how to make propaganda films. So there's far more films being made during the war about the war in the Second World War.
So did the government have quite a lot of say of what was produced in Hollywood during wartime?
Yes. The agency was called the Office of War Information in the Second World War, and it had offices in Hollywood that read scripts before they were filmed and then saw the films before they were released and advised the studios on how to portray war issues.
Did that cause any friction, or were the studios in general quite happy to go along with that?
That, of course, caused a lot of friction because the Office of War Information did not like the kind of fantastic plots and far-fetched ideas that, you know, are a normal part of Hollywood films. And they were continually telling Hollywood, no, don't do that. Don't exaggerate. Don't make it worse than it is. And they were also... they were quite keen to prevent what they called hate pictures. They didn't want to rile up hatred towards Germany in particular. They insisted that there should be the bad Germans should be identified as Nazis, but there could also be good Germans who resisted the Nazis. So they sort of walked a tightrope with that. But with regards to Japan, they didn't balk at anything. They allowed these remarkably racist portrayals of the Japanese, which when you go back and watch films from this era, it is quite shocking to see how blatantly racist they were.
So in that respect, then Hollywood is incredibly powerful. I mean, what about a huge impact on public opinion in this time?
Yes, and I think Washington recognized that, and that's why they were so eager to go out there and eager to intervene. Films were seen by a lot of people, but also a lot of people who didn't read newspapers or magazines or pay attention to the news. So it was a way of reaching further into the population.
And that takes us on quite nicely to a next question, which was submitted by Gareth Taylor on Facebook. And he asked, what kind of impact did McCarthyism have on Hollywood?
McCarthyism had a terrible influence on Hollywood. And I think we can think about that from on an individual level, that there were individuals whose careers were ruined, in some cases simply because they signed petitions in the 1930s, and they lost their careers, or they continued working but under pseudonyms. You know, there's a I think Dalton Trumbo is probably the most famous of the screenwriters who continued to work, but had to do it under a pseudonym and therefore didn't get paid, or got paid a fraction of what he would have been paid before. That's the individual level. On a larger level, McCarthyism made Hollywood more timid. It was afraid to be seen to be dramatizing anything controversial. So from the late 40s into the 50s, films become just a little blander, just a little safer than I think they would have been without that. And certainly that there's a period right as the war ends when some really interesting films are made that are socially realist, engaging with contemporary issues and events, and that McCarthyism shuts that down.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
You can find terror in the most mundane places, it's Psycho has many, many, many children, and horror continues to be such a popular genre.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So when we're talking about McCarthyism, are we specifically talking about communism? And anything that could be construed as promoting communism was basically in the crosshairs. Is that right?
McCarthyism was about communism, but it was also anything that was seen to be anti-American. So if your listeners know the film The Best Years of Our Lives, which was a film about three veterans coming home after the war to a middle American town. And I show it to my students every year. And it's very hard from our perspective today to see anything subversive in it. But it was regarded then by the right wing, by the people who supported McCarthyism, as being a subversive film because it questions big business and banks, and doesn't portray them in an absolutely favorable light. So it was anything that seemed to question capitalism in any way, shape, or form, question big business, and that didn't seem to be overwhelmingly patriotic. Anything that didn't seem patriotic was labeled subversive.
Would I be right in saying that Charlie Chaplin was caught up in this as well?
Yes, Chaplin had made The Great Dictator in 1940. So before America was at war, Chaplin made The Great Dictator, which was a wonderfully funny lampooning film of Hitler. And so he was one of the people in Hollywood who was eager to use the film industry to expose Nazism, and in this case, Hitler in particular, before America entered the war. And he makes a plea at the end of the film for peace and for an international order that will bring about long-lasting peace. Well, after the war, that was regarded as what they called premature anti-fascism. So it was okay to be against fascism during the war, but he was a premature anti-fascist, and that the speech he gives at the end of the film was regarded as very left-wing, and so he was really hounded by the McCarthyites, and eventually left the United States. I think it was in 1952 he left and did not return.
I mean, that must have been a pretty big deal. I mean, Charlie Chaplin was a global star, wasn't he?
He was. I mean, his career was in its autumn years. He wasn't making very many films at that stage of his career, and they weren't. The Great Dictator was a huge success, but subsequently his films were not that successful.
Okay, the next question we've had submitted, this is on Facebook from Kira Boyle, and her question is, how did Hollywood influence perceived beauty standards in women across the Western world?
When you look at the credits of Hollywood films, you can see that they often have the makeup and beauty companies are credited. When you look at Hollywood fan magazines from the Golden Age in particular, Hollywood stars are often advertising the makeup and hairstyling products. And I think this has been part of the strategy all along, was to... in a way, celebrate artifice, that beauty and glamour are wrapped up in artifice, and it's something you need to obtain. It's something you need to work towards and to style yourself with, of course, consumer products. That's been the case since the beginning. And of course, it's accentuated in Hollywood films and in publicity shots through lighting and dress as well. And so when you see a star like Greta Garbo in her Swedish films and in her Swedish publicity, she looks like a perfectly normal, attractive young woman. When she gets to Hollywood, they put her through a process which involves, she was told to lose a lot of weight, and she did. Her hair was restyled, her makeup was redone. She was lit in very careful in particular ways, and she looks like a completely different person. Very glamorous, very beautiful, but also quite artificial.
And I guess ordinary people around the world took their cue from the image that she was portraying.
Yes, and bought the products that promised them that this was obtainable.
Right, next question is from Luke Gulchi, and this was submitted on Instagram, and that is, when was the Hollywood sign renovated?
Yes, it's an absolutely iconic sign, and so it's funny to learn that it was put up in 1923 as a temporary sign, and it was just made of wood, and it was put up, it actually, the sign at that point read Hollywood Land, because Hollywood Land was a subdivision that was being built, and this was the advertisement for it. And the sign was meant to be up for about a year, And people got used to it, and it stayed up, but it gradually disintegrated, and some of the letters fell over, and so it went through a lot of problems. And Los Angeles, Hollywood was part of Los Angeles by this time. It had been incorporated into Los Angeles. They tried to fix it several times. They would try and fix it, but eventually, in the late 1970s, they had to replace the old wooden structure completely and make a steel structure, and a steel structure set in concrete. So, you know, the letters would stop blowing over, and they would survive the wind and the occasional rain. So at that point, the sign became much more fixed and secure. There were several points in its history prior to that when it didn't read much of anything because the letters had fallen over.
I mean, I've never been to Hollywood. I mean, how impressive is it to see it in person, as it were?
It's very impressive, and when you fly into Los Angeles, you pass it, and you know you've arrived. You know where you are, it's like any city's iconic landmarks. You want to see it, and you feel like you're there when you've seen it.
Right now, it's another popular query on the internet, and that is related to the 70s and 80s blockbusters. I mean, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the rise of these blockbusters. I'm talking the likes of Star Wars, Jaws, Indiana Jones. I mean, to what extent did they prove a shot in the arm for Hollywood? And how did they represent a kind of a change in direction from what had gone before?
There was this transitional moment in Hollywood in the late 60s and early 70s as an older generation of filmmakers weren't doing very well, and television had pretty much taken the audience from Hollywood. So there's a kind of financial crisis going on. And that opened up a space for a younger generation of filmmakers to come in. The Spielbergs, George Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, they come in. And at first, they're making quite low-budget, interesting, experimental films. Experimental is probably an exaggeration, but it's like if you've seen American Graffiti, for example, the George Lucas film, it's quite adventurous in the way it tells its story. And what's odd about this is they come in, they're this new generation, and they're making new and innovative films, new kinds of films. But when they become successful, they then go for the big blockbuster projects like Jaws, like Star Wars, like Indiana Jones. And the industry then goes from this experimental, almost indie filmmaking phase into a preoccupation with blockbusters and the idea that the more money you spend on a film, the better it is, and that every film should speak to an audience, a mass audience, that, you know, and its opening weekend has to be fantastic so that everybody feels as though they need to go see it. And it's a real change in Hollywood and not necessarily one for the better aesthetically.
So was box office numbers, money made, was it more important at that point than ever before, would you say?
Yes, box office became increasingly important in the sense of the opening weekend. So what you had back in the golden era was that films would be released very, very gradually. They would open in big cities and then spread out. And so films had a long time to find an audience. It may be that they didn't do well in the big cities, but they did well in the small towns and out in the regions. So there were lots of different kinds of markets for films, and they had a better chance. As the emphasis on blockbusters grew, it really became all about the opening weekend. And films could die a death very quickly if they didn't immediately find a big audience.
Just on that note, how would you define that? I mean, what is a blockbuster? How would you define the blockbuster?
A blockbuster is probably a very expensive film, a film with high production values, a concept film, a film which the story can be quite easily relayed, and one that reaches the largest possible audience.
Sure. And how much of an impact did special effects have it at this point? It seems to me that they did, but I mean, was it more than ever before?
Now, I think there's always been an emphasis on special effects in Hollywood, and that's one of the things that Hollywood has done so well. So I wouldn't say that's definitely a part of it. I mean, if we think back to it's well known now, all the problems they had with the shark in Jaws. The shark just kept breaking, and at some points the shark doesn't really look that realistic, and at some point Spielberg realized we should look through the shark's eyes rather than look at the shark, because it's much more effective. So special effects have always been important. I wouldn't pin that on the 70s in particular.
So could you give us an example of one, say, in the earlier decades, the 20s, 30s, or 40s, which is a real leap forward in terms of special effects?
In 1935 or 36, there's a film called San Francisco, which depicts the great San Francisco earthquake at the beginning of the century. That was a film that amazed people for its special effects. But remember, there's also that apocryphal story of audiences rushing out of their seats when there's a very, very, very early one reel film about the arrival of a train. Not about the arrival of a train, it just shows the arrival of a train. And the audience reportedly, possibly, jumped out of their seats. So there's always been this idea that film is there to thrill, and that any kind of artifice is okay if it's thrilling enough. And I think that's always been at the heart of the Hollywood ethos.
Sure. Now, more recently, how has Hollywood reacted to the decline in cinema going and the rise in new technologies? I mean, I was about to say that DVD and Blu-ray, I mean, they're obviously not new anymore. They've aged quite a lot, but you know what I mean? And then, of course, there's the advent of myriad digital channels and streaming platforms. I mean, how has Hollywood coped with that?
I think Hollywood's coped with that in the same way that it's coped with all the other changes to its business model over the years. Remember, there was a time when, in order to see a film, you had to go to the cinema that week or two that it was playing, and then you never had the chance again. Then came television. Then came showing films on television, seeing films on planes, getting VHS tapes, and on and on and on. So, I think these changes scare the industry in the first instance, and then they think, how can we make money out of this? How do we use this to our advantage? The trend seems to me that people see more and more films, and that we have more and more outlets to see them. And so these are business opportunities to Hollywood, and they find ways of working with them. And the pandemic simply accelerated a trend that was already happening, that more and more films were being seen through streaming. I think it probably would have taken another 10 years to get to the point we are now, where some major films are released through streaming in their first weekend. That's their only or their primary release. It would have taken longer to get there, but we were headed that way anyway.
So it's accelerating something that was going to happen, a bit like working from home, maybe. Is it accelerating
exactly.
Something that would have happened anyway?
The pandemic accelerated so many trends that were already in place.
Sure. But speaking of Hollywood, I mean, is it as preeminent in the film, global film industry, as it's always been? Is it still the cultural powerhouse that it was, say, 40 or 50 years ago, would you say?
It is, from a business point of view. But I think what we see with Netflix, for example, is the funding being given out to a wider array of players. So Netflix funds movies and shows and programs all around the world because it wants international viewers. So it's still the business capital. It's still the source of a lot of production money, but the industry is not entirely based. The international film industry is not entirely based in Hollywood anymore.
Would you say is as creative as it's always been?
Yes, I would. I would, and perhaps creative in different ways. Different times call for different ways, but they're wonderful films being made.
And what would you say the future looks like for Hollywood? Is it possible to predict what's going to happen over the next 20 years?
I think it's interesting to speculate, to think about whether we're going to continue to watch films in cinemas, in theaters, whether we're going to continue to gather as a community, as an audience, and watch films together. Because that can be such a powerful way of watching a film. And I think the question is, are we going to become so atomized that we're all watching at home alone and not having that great experience? There will be more and better special effects. I'm sure of that. We see that coming, and to what extent that requires cinema viewing over home viewing remains to be seen.
Sure. Now, Mark, I can't let you go without asking you the following two questions. What do you regard as the three most influential Hollywood films in history? And also, who do you regard as the three most influential actors? So I'm putting you on the spot a bit here, but...
Yes, I feel obliged to say the most influential film of all time is Citizen Kane, because I'm a film historian who knows that that is true. But it's the most predictable answer I could possibly give, right? It was a very, very influential film, and if you haven't seen it, you should watch it, and then you'll see how often other films imitate it. But I don't want to give such a predictable answer. So let me choose films by genre. And I'm going to say, fantasy plays such a huge role in films now, fantasy and adventure, that I'm going to choose The Wizard of Oz as a particularly influential film, because fantasy wasn't such a big part of popular films when The Wizard of Oz came out in 1939. And it's so wonderfully made, so imaginative, and still shows all the time now. And its use of color, its invention of new imaginary lands. It's staggering. It's still staggering, and often imitated. For the horror genre, I think it has to be Psycho. Because Psycho was the film that brought everyday, ordinary horror into our lives. So not monsters, not Frankenstein, not Dracula, not Godzilla, but the shower. That you can find terror in the most mundane places. It's Psycho has many, many, many children, and horror continues to be such a popular genre. And for comedy, I'm going to say Bringing Up Baby, because that was such a wonderful screwball comedy with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. And it wasn't the first screwball comedy. And in fact, it wasn't even that popular when it was initially released, but it's showed since then. It's been watched so many times. And it's, you know, they meet cute, they go on an adventure together, they gradually fall in love. There's a lot of slapstick comedy, there's a lot of banter, and it's, I think it's what a lot of filmmakers aspire to, making a comedy that's that funny and sharp.
Sure.
Influential actors. Predictably, I'm going to go for Cary Grant because he, as an actor, his performances seem so natural and understated. But Cary Grant was an actor who understood that if you raise your eyebrow by a millimeter on screen, that looks like a huge gesture, right? On the big screen, that's a huge gesture. So he really was a perfect screen actor in his understanding of how to look natural and convey thoughts without doing a lot of heavy lifting. And by contrast, my other one's going to be Marlon Brando, who wasn't the first method actor, but he popularized method acting, that much more physical, emotional style of acting. He brought that to Hollywood, and particularly in Streetcar Named Desire, which, if you haven't seen, is such a powerful performance by Marlon Brando. And, you know, certainly there's a whole generation of actors, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, who belong to the Brando school. And then I'm going to go for Bette Davis, because she played such a wide range of roles, and she, starting in the 1930s and lasting until the 1960s, she was never afraid to appear unattractive. She played an incredible range of roles. She was everything from Queen Elizabeth to a Cockney waitress and the Southern Belle of Jezebel and on and on and on. But she had a style of acting that used a lot of gestures, a lot of mannerisms that I think defined what acting was for a generation. Not to do with glamour, because she wasn't beautiful, but to do with playing a wide range of roles and having performance skills that were noticeable. And I would say her influence extends to Meryl Streep and to Cate Blanchett and many, many others.
That was Mark Glancy, Professor of Film History at Queen Mary University of London. His most recent book is Cary Grant, The Making of a Hollywood Icon. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.